Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalists. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and we are starting a new month, August the 1st, 2018. Once in a while we come across somebody, we come across a personality that is so close to what we're all about. Someone who's almost identical. Someone who typifies our struggle almost exactly. And today we're going to talk about someone who I've been studying for some time. I forget about him for a while, then I go back to him. He, of course, is totally unknown amongst non-Greek Orthodox, with a few exceptions. Unknown to historians, of course. And is one of the greatest military men of the Middle Ages. That's the Emperor John III, Doukas Vitaxis of Nicaea, who died in 1254. John III typifies what we do because he was Byzantium in exile. This is after the Latin Church, or really the Venetian oligarchy, had diverted its fourth crusade to take Constantinople. In doing that, established the so-called Latin Empire, highly unstable, very unpopular, including among its own people. And those carrying on Greek Byzantium fled, and there were two centers of resistance, Epirus and Nicaea, two major cities of the empire. And thanks to John III, Nicaea became the dominant resisting force of Orthodox Byzantium. Even from a Roman Catholic point of view, the sack of 1204 was senseless. It was not authorized by the Pope. It was accepted by him and celebrated after the fact, but was not something that he sought to do. He regretted it, but only to a certain extent. Innocent III was a very strong man, very firm in his view of the papacy. In fact, the architect of the papacy, the way we know it, at least until the 20th century. And of course, he is not going to be all that upset about New Rome being conquered. He is upset, though, in the way that it was done, that so many sacred objects were destroyed and blasphemed, that ultimately it was for the glory of Venice and the oligarchy, not the Church of Rome. However, Innocent was very, very quick to recognize the empire and give it his blessing and to demand that it be defended at all costs. So it's, in Byzantium, you know, we've dealt with so many topics in this before, that you have at least two centers of power. You have the political and you have the religious. The Roman West, you know, at least as far as the papacy is concerned, you have one. And then the Pope created these uneasy concordats with increasingly strong national leaders, especially in France and Germany. And those of you who know anything about the Middle Ages realize that this became a problem, especially as far as the German Empire is concerned. The German Empire of the Etonians, or Conradians, whatever you want to call it, was very humane, very well organized. And as always, it was a war against oligarchy. As always, the monasteries were the principle of centralization. It shouldn't surprise you that John III was an ally of the German Empire in its fight against the Latin Empire in Constantinople. From a Catholic point of view, the Crusader states and even the Latin Empire and Constantinople itself were huge drains on Western Europe. They destroyed far more than they built. These tiny little highly unstable kingdoms were draining a huge amount of resources, men, gold from Western Europe and elsewhere. And the bottom line is that this was really about Italian merchant interests, not about Western Europe, not about Catholicism. These little, whether it be the crusading states, I guess you could call the Latin Empire a crusading state, the little statelet that the sacrament of Constantinople built after 1204. I guess you could call it a crusader state. I guess it is a crusader state. But they were all very unstable. They were all deeply divided. They were drawing a huge amount of resources from Western Europe. They were very hard to defend. And of course, extremely unpopular. One of the things that makes a man great is not when he does well under normal circumstances. Now, you take a man today in, let's say, with a military career, he gets to be a colonel, say, in the Army or the Air Force. Well, that's really unremarkable. Those services are screaming for men. They're throwing money at anyone who will sign up and stay. They reward conformity and playing the game and political correctness, not merit. So it's really not that big of a deal. You go up the ranks, say in military, you're working for a company that can't go out of business, a huge budget. Because the wars are now for Israel, there's a huge prestige attaching to the military life. There's nothing extraordinary about this. The metal inflation that I've written about in the past. Everyone and their mother has a bronze star now. This is not achievement. It's when you are up against it. It's when you are in exile, when you have nothing and nobody, and you still carve out not just a life, but a powerful life. This is what greatness is. And this is what John III did. The point was to pick up the pieces of a shattered Byzantium, shattered self-confidence, go to these small regions in Asia Minor that have very little arable land, and rebuild some miniature version of the Roman Empire. His greatness is that he did it. His greatness is that he's the one not only who did precisely this, but created a tremendous economy, created a firmly nationalist state, set the stage for retaking Constantinople, and saw tremendous economic growth and administrative reform. You know, it's one thing for an emperor of Byzantium, you know, centuries before, to do very, very well with a lot of money and a large land area. It's something else when you have almost nothing and you're able to build something this extraordinary. And this is the reason that I consider John III to be one of the greatest men of the Middle Ages, certainly one of the greatest military leaders of the Middle Ages. At the time, it was extremely difficult to be a Roman Catholic in this part of the world. The Crusaders were simply imposing Latin bishops on Greek sees. They were the only people who went to church, though. The Latin Benedictine monastery, Mount Athos, was burned to the ground. Almost to the 14th century, you had a Benedictine monastery on Athos, Amalfion, a very powerful, one of the larger ones actually, was destroyed by these crusaders. The war apparently had shifted from fighting Islam to now profits for the Venetians. John III was in the garrison of Constantinople when it was attacked by the crusaders. As he gave his substantial fortune to the poor once he went into exile. He fought almost to the very end and finally was able to escape with a handful of men. And very quickly established himself. He is a second emperor. Theodore Lascaris is, let's call him Theodore, was the first one. But and then Theodore, of course, laid the groundwork for what John III was to do. So the reason we talk about him is that here's a man who was sent into exile, who was sent with nothing, a handful of men, in a very poor area with a very little arable land, and he created a large, successful, powerful empire. He carved it out of a rock, quite literally. This is a sort of historical example. These are the people who we need to be looking up to. And of course, he's a kind of nice saint in the church for a whole bunch of reasons. Church has a long history of these military saints. Christianity is a violent religion, and it will always be. But that violence has to be well organized for the right purpose through legitimate Orthodox government. And it can't be done for personal gain. It can't be done for passion. You can't go into battle hating, you know, I'm going to get my revenge on these people. That can't be the attitude. There's nothing wrong with violence. There's nothing wrong with killing under these circumstances. Somehow in America, Christians have all become followers of Leo Tolstoy. Death is not the worst thing that could happen to somebody. Physical pain is certainly not the worst thing that could happen to somebody. But in an age where everyone seeks comfort at all cost, these violent acts seem terribly distasteful. Well, that would make sense if you're, you know, an American who doesn't believe anything's worth fighting for. And certainly nothing's worth dying for. That's the abulia that we talk about quite often on this show. There is nothing wrong with violence. There is nothing wrong with killing the enemies of the church. And God smiles upon this, and God has given great blessings and sainthood to those who've done it. But again, the purpose has to be for God's glory and not your own. And the very fact that John gave his fortune away, you know, he wasn't collecting booty here. It was, you know, like Gideon in the Old Testament. He was going to be made king, and he said no. He went back to farming his plot. So clearly, John wasn't about his own personal glory here. He had an extremely difficult mission. There were numerous assassination attempts. The Latin Empire, back and forth connections with Rome, and it was a very uneasy relationship, tried to create revolts against him, palace coups. They went to his brothers to try to kill him. They used the Cumans, this kind of semi-Turkic people, as auxiliary troops to try to overthrow him. It was, they did everything they could to destroy this guy. So carving out an empire from a rock, he remade Byzantium. He remade the entire Greek East with absolutely nothing. The economic growth that he created there was extraordinary. And with that, drove the Latins out of Asia Minor. He created a massive merchant fleet and destroyed the Latin Navy, which really was, for the most part, the Venetian Navy, and used Genoa and created a distrust. Of course, there were always the two competitor states, so they could fight each other. To a great extent, he took command of the sea. His great battle, of course, 1224, the Battle of Pomaneroi, just right up the south coast of the Sea of Marmara, where the Latin army was defeated, and of course the Latin Empire never really recovered from that blow. And they weren't expecting a man who really was living on a rock to create an army that motivated and with that kind of money behind it to defeat experienced crusaders. Now Theodore was the first emperor of Nicaea immediately after 1204. And his brothers, as Alexander and Isaac, were paid by the Latins to kill John. Theodore had brought the last patriarch, John X, to Nicaea, and then Michael IV, who was elected afterwards. Now, unfortunately, the difference between Epirus and Epirus and Nicaea, you had two rival churches. But as always in these kind of cases, they're both quite legitimate. It's no one's fault that it was this split like this, and so we don't worry about it. You're never going to have a perfect canonical order in such an emergency situation. But God takes care of his own. How was it that John was able to do this? Well, for one, the Latin Empire was very much irritating to the Bulgarians, which were building the so-called Second Medieval Bulgarian Empire, which was huge and very wealthy, and was in the process of becoming very strictly Orthodox. I guess for a while, Tsar of Bulgaria had good relations with Innocent III. But the problem is, Crusaders often had a mind of their own, and the Crusaders began burning Bulgarian villages, and they soon walked into a Bulgarian ambush. Both sides used the Turkish Cumans in this war, unfortunately. And because of the defeat, yet again, of another Latin crusading army, that was where it wasn't supposed to be. That was diverted from its initial purpose. Really didn't have a purpose in this case. The Latin Empire was in serious trouble. Add to this the fact that the German Empire was at war with the papacy. And the fact that the Crusaders, you know, it wasn't like today. You didn't have, you know, cell phones. You couldn't. Communications was very weak. You had very, very powerful, often very arrogant aristocrats taking over whole armies in that part of the world and were kind of doing their own thing. And when the Venetians were throwing money at them, it's very, very easy to divert them. But Theodore wanted to build the economy before he did anything else. And he married the niece of Henry, the Henry of Flanders, Marie de Courtenay. And, but, you know, Theodore reigned Theodore reigned in Epirus, 1224 to 1230. Theodore, Adukas. And allied with Serbia, took the second city of the empire in Thessalonica. So, you know, you have two sets of, you have two coalitions. You have Epirus under Theodore Komnenos Doukas, who was allied with Serbia, trying to check Bulgaria, who took Epirus as well as Thessalonica. This was a big, and Macedonia, big problem. Then you had John III and the Bulgarians building an empire in that part of the world. And Thessalonica really was the prize most of the time. Bulgaria and Serbia were fighting each other, at least to the extent that they didn't want one to get larger than the other. So when Serbia had its chance to go with Epirus, it did so. But at the same time, they both had the Latin Crusaders as their enemy. Baldwin, of course, very famous Latin emperor, had a peace treaty with John Aston of the Bulgarian Empire, who actually did have a claim to Byzantium, and in an alliance defeated his army in the Battle of Pokonica. So, and Theodore of Epirus was captured by John. Now, they're on the same side. I mean, they all want the Latin Empire gone. The Latin Empire is clearly in trouble. He brought Theodore back to Nicaea, wouldn't let him leave, but when he went on campaigns, he made sure he brought him in tow. But the powerful thing that Epirus had was the very strong, very powerful Sea of Ohrid, one of its major cities, and having Thessalonica and Macedonia, it was quite a wealthy place, actually larger than that of Nicaea, but not as well run. The Ecumenical Patriarch at 1206 was Michael IV, nominated by Lascaris. And Patriarch Emmanuel in 1222 in Nicaea was the one who raised St. Sava to create the independent Serbian archbishopric. He was able to take advantage of the divisions there and building allies. So the players are, of course, Bulgarian Empire, which is very large, the Serbian Empire, which was just growing, John III, the Empire of Epirus, and then you're including Thessalonica and Macedonia in one unit, as well as the Latin Empire, and now the introduction of the Turks to the south. Now, Theodore was interested in approaching the Roman Pope. It was Pope Honorius at the time now. The concept is to exploit the divisions between the Latin Empire and the papacy. Those divisions were already being exploited in the German Empire and the papacy. Kind of the crusading spirit was revitalized by Peter II de Courtenay. He then attempted to retake Thessalonica, which would have been a huge coup for the Latin Empire, but it failed. Theodore had met Peter, and after the failure to take Thessalonica, and said, listen, we have a common enemy here. Our enemies are the Jews and Islam. We should be doing this. He very reluctantly said, okay. The Venetians were not happy with him there. But then, being lulled into this kind of complacency, Theodore then ambushed him and destroyed him. The problem that Peter II had, and the reason why Theodore behaved in such a violent way, is that he discovered that Peter II was taking captured lands and selling them to the Venetians. In other words, entire cities, entire areas were being serfs to the Venetian commercial empire. And this was a big problem with the Latins. This was their connection to the world with Venice. They had a creation of the Venetians. Again, all these things were very uneasy alliances. But without the constant flow of money from Venice, these institutions can't function for 3 minutes. This is why John III was so obsessed, absolutely obsessed with autarky, to be completely self-sufficient under all circumstances. Because he's looking at the Latins, saying they're connected with Rome and Venice, which is extremely confusing, which means they have very little freedom of action, and it weakens them. John III, with very little arable land, but with strong ideological and religious backing, created an almost self-sufficient empire. Remember, too, nationalism here in the High Middle Ages became absolutely essential. Now, nationalism always exists in the sense that an ethnic group understands that it's different from every other one. That doesn't take a genius. But to politicize it is another matter. That's been the case in places like Poland and Ireland for millennia. But in Greece, it became a politicized concept. It was a Greek nationalist empire that was being created in Nicaea. Clearly, the distinctions in language and customs and mentality between the Venetians, say, and the Greeks couldn't be any more blatant. This is another reason that John was really absorbed with being self-sufficient, because he didn't want, he saw the internationalism of the Venetians, the internationalism of the Roman papacy, and he saw how it weakened not only their own church, but how it weakened their military operation. The Latin Empire, the Crusading Empires, were failures for this very reason. They simply weren't stable enough. So it wasn't long before Pope Honorius had declared yet another crusade against Theodore. Theodore had cut communication between Thessalonica and Constantinople. And now the Latin Empire is in serious trouble. The Latin army had attacked Sarus in 1224. And once they heard about John III's defeat of the Latin forces in Asia Minor, they scattered. So the Latin army really fell to pieces. And Honorius had cut off all connection with Theodore, and so this crusade had fallen apart very quickly. And it was simply because of John III. Religion, you know, wasn't the issue here. It was Venetian power, Genoese power, the influence of different powerful noble families extending their influence in the Middle East. That was the issue. Of course, the Greeks had been there, you know, for millennia prior to this. They belonged there. The Latins were invaders. But Theodore eventually took Thessalonica and maintained it, as you say, and he was seen even as a liberator of Orthodoxy. And in 1228, he was crowned Emperor of the Romans by the Archbishop of Ulrich. And John was quite willing to recognize this. It's a bit of a problem. There are a lot of people who thought it was very presumptuous for him to take the full imperial dignity and Thessalonica. It was the second city of the empire. But then the Synod in Epirus in 1227 said that if you guys don't recognize us as the Roman Empire, if you guys don't recognize us as a seat of the Ecumenical Patriarchate, we will go to the Roman Pope. Metropolitan Germanos, or actually Patriarch Germanos of Nicaea, had excommunicated Theodore for taking this title without synodal permission, or synodal permission beyond, you know, his own people. I'm not saying that Epiros or Epiros versus Nicaea, one is better than the other. John was far superior in almost every respect. They did what they had to do under very difficult circumstances. We cannot judge their behaviors. They were on the same side, and they were both very good men. But by 1227, you had Theodore, you have John Aston of Bulgaria, Robert of Courtney, the Crusader, of course, and John III, all claiming title to Constantinople. Theodore being really, now the Latin had an emperor there that the Pope had crowned, and then, or a legate had crowned. And Theodore had already taken the imperial dignity through the Archbishop of Ohrid, now part of the Bulgarian church. In a very dumb move, in 1229, Theodore sent his army into Bulgaria. And this is the Battle of Klokonica, where he was defeated. Now, the one thing about Theodore is, of course, he was confiscating the lands of the Jews and the usurers, which were overwhelmingly Jewish, to finance his campaign. And so John Aston of Bulgaria hired a group of Jews to kill him. So it was very clear that he had a willing audience with them. Both Theodore and John were vehemently against usury and confiscated the lands of those engaging in it. So the Bulgarians did a dirty trick, and when he invaded Bulgaria, remember he was allied with the Serbs, John Aston had hired two Jews to murder him. Theodore is now gone. John Aston dies in 1241. In Thessalonica, Manuel took over. And now you had, all roughly in the same period of time, John III now saw his chance. So in this 15-year era, the tremendous confusion on the Orthodox side became simpler and simpler. No one's going to judge either side. I mean, John III was really impeccable in his moral behavior. He lived a Spartan, intensely ascetic life, unlike Theodore. But Theodore didn't lead any a particular luxurious life. He wasn't Mao Zedong or Trotsky, who lived the life of a millionaire. No, they were ascetics by comparison. But John III made it a point. You know, Theodore had taken Adrianople. And this is so we get Thessalonica and Adrianople, and then this is how they were going to attack Constantinople itself. This was the problem. Because he had taken, now, several major cities. He wanted to knock Bulgaria out of the running, and that was really the big problem that he had. This was a huge error on his part. Instead of working with the Bulgarians, he attempted to drive them away, and his army in the Balkans was defeated. So, John III outlives them all. We're all on the same side here. John Aston, Theodore, John, they're all, you know, anti-Latin, or I should say anti-Venetian. And of course, the German Empire is a part of this. I might want to add that the Mongols, so-called, you know, Scythians, Neo-Scythians under Tamerlane had destroyed, the initial Mongol, Slavic attack on, destroyed the Turks, which completely freed John up in the south. The Seljuk Turks were destroyed by the forces of, we've discussed who the Mongols were. Mongols that refer to an ethnic group. It's Greek, you know, comes from the word megalo or great. It's, you know, you call them Neo-Scythians, whatever you want to call them. They weren't Asians. No one ever, all the contemporary writings don't refer to them as Asians. But they had come into this area, freed up John III by destroying the Seljuk Turkish threat to his south, which really relieved pressure on him, relieved pressure on the Greeks, and allowed him to reorganize his army to head to point northward. So both Theodore and John were interested in expansion. They were interested in expansion for their own purposes, but mostly to create an economic foundation to be able to retake Constantinople. the walls were still the Theodosian walls. They could not be penetrated. There were many attempts to besiege Constantinople. They all failed. They knew it would fail. You know, John III and Theodore both had worked on those walls. They knew them very well. What had to happen is that they had to build an alternative empire to starve the Latins out, or because it's such an irrational organization, the Crusader states were so irrational to begin with, they'll fall under their own weight. They were very costly, poorly led militarily, they were deeply divided. And you know what happens when you have these problems is that you tend to go to the Jews for money. You tend to go to places like Turkey or the Cumans for auxiliary soldiers. You do desperate things that desperate men do. I'm not saying these guys did this necessarily all the time, but when you're running out of money, you do what you have to do to survive. And unfortunately, this was a problem everywhere except for John III. John III was the only one who coined his own money. He maintained the Byzantine currency standard. And because of his tremendous trading policies, we have to get into this right now, understanding how, you know, he could do this. How can he maintain his gold coinage, have it be taken very seriously in the Mediterranean? Is that he carved this empire out of a rock, but he did it, you know, on a Greek nationalist basis with strong peasant equality, rewards for hard work, a strong monastic presence. I think the monastics were encouraged to continue to work, to cultivate new lands, what little there was, so they had to intensively farm. It was all discipline. So he built this tremendous prosperity without relying on foreign trade. In fact, John III had banned foreign luxury goods because not only were they expensive, but they were decadent. He ordered that his subjects had to wear homespun clothing. In this kind of emergency situation, you don't need to buy luxuries. Luxuries mean you have to press your servants, you press your workers, have to give you more. No, you don't need that. Our survival is more important. That wasn't the case elsewhere. That wasn't the case with Theodore. John was far more motivated ideologically. He was far more of a Spartan ascetic in the Orthodox sense. He was more of a great soldier and statesman than Theodore was. He certainly didn't threaten to run to the Pope of Rome if his title wasn't recognized, which was an awful thing that the Synod of Epirus did under Theodore's direction. What's great about John III is not the rumors and legends that developed afterwards. To me, that's very unimportant. Why were there these legends in the first place? Nicaea was gaining in strength throughout this period of time, the 1220s on down. He was able to build his merchant fleet, which then soon took Lesbos, Acadia, Samos, Chios, Lemnos. He took major trading cities on islands and incorporated them into his society. No one thought that he was a problematic ruler, except the Latins, of course. He is sitting right in the middle of major trade routes. You know, everything in Asia Minor going south, the Latin Empire itself, the Cretans were under the Venetians, and the same thing for anything from Salonika. So in building this merchant fleet and being able to defeat the Venetians, which is saying something, he created the notion of this foundational economic basis, not only of what a Byzantine really was supposed to be, but created a national empire, created a national state strong enough and legitimate enough that now he can be a real claimant of Constantinople as the Latin Empire is increasingly tottering. It didn't take long. He ended up taking Nyssa, Tyre, Laodicea. And then throughout this period of time, of course, the Greeks were revolting against Latin rule. John was sending ships to Crete. Even the Bulgarians were assisting these revolts that were breaking out all over the Latin Empire. The Latins created this kind of Norman-style feudalism and brought it over to Greece, they had no conception of feudalism before. In the technical Western European sense, it did not exist in the East, but these aristocrats coming over from France were imposing feudalism on the Greek population who had never known it before. So revolts were everywhere. It was very, so the Latin Empire was so poorly run, it was so ham-handed, that, you know, some of their merchants were using John III's currency. It was the one that was, the most stable. John III was willing to give everything he had to support these revolts all over the place. You know, you have a million little islands. The Latins aren't used to that. You know, if you don't have an extremely strong navy, you don't know how to work the kind of island hopping warfare, you're not going to win. I mean, by 1241, Epirus was destroyed by the Bulgarians. It's not to say that this is a good thing, but that rivalry had to end. You know, there's no question that rivalry had to end. And even, you know, even Theodore, through no fault of his own, was giving the Venetians free trading rights that Greeks didn't have. This was a way to raise money. And this is something that John III never did. I'm not judging him necessarily. You know, they're desperate for cash. They're in exile. What do you do? But Venetians were the enemy of everything Byzantine, the enemy of everything Orthodox. The enemy, I mean, this is the alchemical marriage of the sea, Tyre, you know, Atlantic style, trading empire. Venice was, you know, one of the archetypal. And we see in New York and in the American empire today. This empire had to go. This could never be an ally. And giving Venetians any, and the Byzantine empires did this too near the end. One of the reasons that the Byzantine empire became so weak was that in exchange for a forwarding cash, the Venetians were able to exploit the locals. And it was a stupid idea. It's when you're desperate and the short-term demands come first. This is a problem. But at the same time, because of, you know, John's keeping the Venetians out and actually defeating them on sea, you have Venetian oligarchs paying locals to revolt against John. 1235, John and the Bulgarians attempt to take Constantinople and fail because it's Constantinople. Venice intervened at the last minute, harassed them. They couldn't penetrate the walls. As a result of all this, of course, Nicaea had recognized, and by this time, the Orthodox world understood Nicaea is where the Patriarch is, and they recognized Bulgarian autocephaly. This, by the way, is one of the things that kept Bulgaria from going to the Roman Church. The Bulgarians, were in the orbit of Byzantium. They were Orthodox in ritual for the most part, although that wasn't everywhere. But politically speaking, you know, you had the German Empire, you had the papacy itself, you had Byzantium. In this case, Nicaea. Where are they going to go? You cannot claim the German Empire, generally speaking, was Roman Catholic. They were not. It was a national church, so that more or less was out of communion with Rome. Sometimes it was, sometimes it wasn't. But this is how both Serbia and Bulgaria created its autocephalous structures. And the national concept doesn't come from, you know, as the pseudo scholars usually say, it was from the millet system and the triple karate. That is nonsense. The national idea was well developed before then. Bulgarian autocephaly was based on ethnicity, of course, because Bulgaria has to refer to something. And same thing goes for Serbia. And there were very, very specific Serbian and Bulgarian customs that were acceptable, to Byzantium. The whole Byzantine concept of the Commonwealth is that nations really are, you know, are what the world is. An Orthodox nation come together in a kind of a loose federation called the civilization, or the Byzantine Commonwealth headed by the emperor. Nations were very real and always recognized in the basis of church life, but had a local significance only, which is certainly acceptable. There was never any attempt to make Serbs Bulgarians and vice versa. Those attempts came later, and certainly not from the Greek point of view. But John III had built a firmly national, equalitarian, almost a yeomanry. Now, when you have constant warfare like John did, there's a tendency for a military aristocracy to buy up peasant land, and that's true. He was very dependent on the military aristocracy. He had to be. He's only one man. But the military aristocracy at least had a national and Byzantine conception, whereas the oligarchy did not. And even, you know, by even 1238, the Turkish Kumans were being paid to attack John. Around this time also, the island of Rhodes was taken by John. He's already creating this counter network to the Venetians and the Jews. Venice and Jewry were more or less, after the fall of Caesarea, allies, but of course they were competitors as well. And Venice was the dominant financial force, and the Jews resented it. And remember always to keep in mind that there isn't a huge difference between, you know, the Talmudic Judaism and that existed at the time and Islam. You know, Islam comes from Nestorianism. You know, it's far more of a military and political doctrine than it is religion. God is this very, very distant military commander rather than a god in the sense that we use the term. And the Jews were looking around for allies post-Khazaria, and they saw it not only in the Volga Bulgars, centuries earlier, but now in the rising Islamic world. And by this time, Jews have penetrated deeply into the Islamic world, realizing that they can't do much against the Bulgarians under the monarchy. They can't do much against the Serbians under the monarchy. John III is out of the question. The Latins, you know, go back and forth, because they're already establishing themselves very strongly in Poland. Islam was going to be the great victory for them, as the Persians had been in the early part of the Byzantine Empire. The Jews were working with the Persians for a very long period of time, and then the Muslims right up to this very day. They may disagree occasionally on Zionism, but that's unimportant. In the last 2,000 years, they're allies. They're not enemies. So John Aeson and the Second Bulgarian Empire falls apart around 1242. Now John III is able to take the Balkans. The Latins have been, by 1236, John had defeated what they call Latin Romania. He won. And then, as I said, the Mongols had destroyed the Seljuk threat and completely wiped the Turks out of commission. 1244, John III does something eccentric, but necessary. He marries 12-year-old Constantia, the daughter of Frederick II of the German Empire. And finally, in 1246, John takes Thessalonica. What was left of Epirus then accepts John's rulership and the fact that John really is now the emperor of Byzantium in 1248. Now, I know up until this point, it's been a very confusing struggle. I want to point out just a few things. You're dealing with a chaotic situation. You're dealing with a very confusing situation with many partners, or many actors, sometimes partners, sometimes enemies, that are self-interested, but also ideologically interested. You have John Aeson and his predecessors building up Bulgarian power, vacillating between Rome and Constantinople. The Latin Empire, which I think most people realized couldn't last. It was simply too unstable. When the Epirotes took over Thessalonica and Macedonia, it gave a great advantage over John's Nicaea. But Theodore's arrogance, once he took Adrianople and moving north into Bulgarian territory, ended up destroying him. They're all on the same side. The bad guy here, of course, as always, are the Venetians, who created the Fourth Crusade. They were financing the papacy at this point. You know, you can't have, you know, nominally Roman Catholic subjects in Venice and Genoa controlling the world's money supply and not being affected by it. Again, this is why it is so absolutely essential that John III coin his own currency. John maintained pure economic autarky and independence, and it worked. He enforced a certain asceticism on the population, which made him very popular. The division between rich and poor, of course, exists everywhere, but was not greatly pronounced because the wealthy were not permitted any kind of ostentation. They're in an emergency situation. They're in survival mode. They're trying to gain their empire back. He's not going to tolerate rich people buying, you know, gold things when the army needs attention. And he's only one man, but he is already growing. And you know, most people, I mean, look, when Theodore took Thessalonica, he was considered the liberator of orthodoxy because he was. Neither one of these guys, you know, Theodore and John both were very, very good men. Theodore's not a saint, you know, in John's sense, but they're on the same side. I think Theodore is much weaker than John. He was less motivated than John. But the fact that you had two rival states was a problem. It wasn't the problem that the Latin states had, where everyone hated each other. You know, the Latin problems were constantly money, no popular support, imposing foreign ideologies on Greeks and others, iffy relations with the papacy, bad relations with the Germans, and really general ignorance. They were very ignorant about Islam, very ignorant about Byzantium. And this is one of the big reasons that the Crusaders failed. The early Crusades attacked friendly Islamic groups that were allied with, like the Fatimid Caliphate, which was at the time allied with Byzantium. Well, they didn't know that. They just killed anything look Islamic, not realizing what they were doing. And they went in there very arrogantly. They went in there very, this is, you know, centuries earlier, you know, and they really destroyed their own cause. But late 1230s, everything starts to get more simple. Unlike John, when Theodore began growing in wealth and power, it went to his head. I believe Theodore would to be a very good man. In a very, very harsh situation where most of us would have failed. But he wasn't this saintly ascetic that John III was. John III slowly consolidated his power, bringing more and more commercial cities under his control. But those commercial profits went to the nation. And banning luxury goods, you know, foreign trade was iffy. Foreign trade was state-controlled. Bringing in gold, bringing in wealth, sort of this mercantile idea, was, as we've said, to create this foundation to retake Constantinople, what you might call cadre building or community building. There was no chance on retaking Constantinople, dislodging the Latin Empire, not to mention the fact getting rid of those things that caused the Latin Empire to exist in the first place. The divisions, the classes, the privileges given to the Venetians and Jews. These were the problems that caused the destruction of 1204. So much of the wealth of Byzantium was stolen and sent to the West. The very marble, and so many of the, you know, things that built the Gothic cathedrals in the West came from the East. Because they were told this was a heretical sect, the Fourth Crusaders destroyed religious things, you know, icons and chalices and everything else. You know, there was simply no distinction between, in fact, the Muslims actually were probably better in Constantinople than the Roman Catholics were. But I don't want to make this seem like this is the Church of Rome here. The Pope didn't march into Constantinople. Relations between the different crusading orders, different aristocrats running their own private armies, that was complex enough. The relations with the papacy were on again, off again. The Pope, even when as strong as Innocent, had no idea what they were doing at any given time. He didn't like the idea of attacking Bulgaria. He didn't like the idea of attacking Constantinople. The point was to push the Muslims back, which they never did. And in the process, discipline the Jews. Now, at least Theodore recognized this and, you know, banned all of Jewish usury and confiscated the estates of the Kahal. But this is what happens after the fall of Constantinople. Sorry, the fall of Khazaria. They were searching around for their home and they found it in Islam, as we all know. Islam was one big one. And of course, the other one was Islamic Spain. And the third was Poland. And that, a bit later, of course, Northern Europe, Amsterdam. That was the Talmudic network. But just as the Talmudists used, you know, the language and their obsessive self-interest to create this very, very, integrated network with very little transaction costs, refusal to charge interest on each other. Just as that happened amongst the Jews, John III was doing this among the Greeks. This was the key. It was the key to Jewish success in a secular realm. It could be the key to Greek success. John III wouldn't permit amongst themselves this kind of usurious inequality that existed elsewhere, including in Epirus. Theodore didn't have the public support that John did. He didn't have the ideology that John did. He didn't have the charisma. He didn't have the success. John III was a first-class military man who had nothing but respect for Theodore. You know, they both came up really in the same environment, and they both fought during the sack against crusaders. But in building these alliances, marrying Constantia in 1244 cemented the alliance between the German Empire and the Orthodox Church. The German Empire was not, there was a Ghibelline movement here, you know, to use another term, building the land base, you know, common good, Platonic Empire against a papacy that had been taken over by banking interests. Michael Hoffman has a whole slew of excellent articles and books on who took over the papacy in terms of in this era, and then later in the Renaissance, the Medici popes. Everyone needs money. Well, it seems that there's two ways to go about it. The first was John's way. You see this to a great extent in Putin's Russia too today. To consolidate all national forces, to discipline oligarchy, to force them to serve the common good, to suppress luxury spending, this kind of thing. You know, social discipline and nationalism. That's the one way. And the other cheaper, easier way, the other short-term way, is what the Polish magnates did. What unfortunately others at the time did, the Latins did, in running off to the Jews. Or becoming Jewish themselves. The Venetian way. And the Venetians would lend money to anybody. The minute the Turks took over Constantinople, 1453, the Venetians were right there offering them money. Because money doesn't really know any national borders. The power that it has is universal. You know, I've said many, many times on this show since, God, I was a teenager talking about how, you know, the oligarchy in Novgorod, you know, would have sold Orthodoxy down the river to protect its property, and they were going to. You see this all over the place. You know, negotiations with Rome weren't so much that they really cared about the Roman Church. Now, there was negotiations between John III and Rome. But he had a problem with it. I mean, ultimately, the talks collapsed. The one thing that he said is that the papacy can no longer authorize any reinforcements to the Latin Empire. The Pope said no. John was willing to compromise on the filioque, not to add the filioque by any means, but simply through the son, which was vague enough to work, which is Orthodox doctrine, certainly not the filioque. Yeah, the man was canonized with this fully understanding. He understood this. And the Roman papacy was very uneasy with it. But they've double-crossed their allies before. Purgatory was the big issue. And from the military point of view, and then from the issue of purgatory, it collapsed. The Seventh Crusade, of course, Louis the Ninth against Islam, you know, to attack Jerusalem, and you know, of course, it was a miserable failure. 1240s, John controlled, you know, an area from Bulgaria to the Black Sea, Adriatic, and then Genoa and Venice began fighting one another. John was concerned with state reform, administrative reform, of course, a strict currency under his control, and land reform. John's greatness is in his domestic policy. Number one, tight control over the court aristocracy. They were not to get too arrogant. They were to be extremely and very strictly moral people. Number two, harsh punishments for any abuse of power. There was a strict legal form for judges and bureaucrats to follow. Number three, non-aristocrats appointed to positions of power. He cared about merit. He cared about getting the job done, not titles. Number four, as we already said, reliance on the military nobility. You know, you need a faction, a powerful people, that, no matter who you are, you need a faction to support you. Number five, aiming at autarky, simplicity. That money goes to the common good, not the public enrichment. Six, tight import controls over Western luxury goods. We also we mentioned the Crusaders were spending a fortune on this crap. He wasn't going to follow their example. Seven, calling a census, then granting each extended family a plot of land that was always going to be there, that cannot be alienated. Eight, any unused land from the aristocracy was given over to these, especially larger families. Punishment was often to take lands and to give it to the poor. Number nine, he himself, of course, a very intense ascetic. Number 10, he did everything he could to fight private wealth. 11, he was at war with usury, and a strong state currency was absolutely essential. 12, the church had to be very strictly autonomous. He was not going to interfere with it. And number 13, he did use foreigners. It was plenty of Latin troops, actually. And Cumans, they settled in Greece. By the way, the Greeks had a tendency to call these guys Scythians and became Greeks themselves. And number 14, people forget about this, founding many libraries and university. Foreigners brought in were very quickly Hellenized. The peasant economy, I mean, this is a yeoman peasantry now with a monetized economy. You know, urban production was strictly for local needs. You didn't have this massive foreign trade like you had elsewhere. Monasteries were absolutely essential. Just like in the German Empire, they were used to hold the system together. You know, profits were put back into peasant land holdings. Because you didn't have a lot of arable land, he was really absorbed and obsessed with improvements to cultivation. His predecessors' concessions to the Latins were repealed. There is a point where he debased his currency, and because you had tremendous economic growth under him, people are wondering why. And the only thing that really could come up with is that you didn't have tons of gold. I mean, there was no natural mines in Nicaea. Some gold was coming in through trade, but trade was generally limited. So you had economic growth, a monetized economy, and not a lot of gold. So it was debased. For no other reason than to create necessary cash. I mean, if you're going to have a problem, let it be that problem. You know, it was simply that. You know, land holdings were inviolable. And of course, the main source of wealth and soldiers and everything else were granted these lands that could not be alienated, at least under most circumstances. And even creating something like you have the intendants under the French monarchy or the missi under Charlemagne, you had the mises, which, as the name suggests, are middlemen. These are royal officials that brought petitions from the common people to the crown. And It was, these were always listened to. These were always heard. All classes were accepted, and there was a rule of law that, that applied to everyone. You know, there were no distinction, especially given the military circumstance. Classes, you didn't have a title nobility in Byzantium, and this is a common mistake. You had those to the old Byzantine court nobility. But this wasn't really what you had in Western Europe. They didn't have, you know, private armies or coats of arms or anything like that. But the Mezuzon was his dedication to this national idea. Foreigners were, of course, attracted to John III's empire, and they had to learn Greek, and they had to become Orthodox, and they were happy to do it because of the nature of the society. There weren't that many. There were some Cumans who joined the army. He needed them, and they very quickly became Helena. So you had a tremendous dedication to the yeoman, you know, citizen soldier. You know, this is the alternative to oligarchy. You know, for whatever benefits the Latins had, they were too connected to Venice to be stable for long. The Latin Empire, first of all, was one that had, you know, slashed its way, into an Orthodox society and was not fighting the Jews, were not fighting, Islam. By the time Louis IX or St. Louis came in, you know, it was too late by then. Islam had been given a new lease on life. That era in the Crusades was an utter disaster. You know, Christians fighting each other, Bulgaria, Serbia, Byzantium, and then, of course, the Latins, Normans. The anti-Islamic coalition was destroyed. Byzantium was the only group that really knew, not only through military attacks, but also intelligence, to do battle and to divide and rule with Muslims. And this is why the Jews went to Islam, because they saw that the Christians were fighting each other. Despite the victories of John III, they always hated John III. Again, with the anti-usury idea, you know, usurious profits were always confiscated. And this is only in a fairly short period of time. And this is a national socialist idea in the Middle Ages, in almost all respects. But it's the alternative to oligarchy. You know, success, strength. How do we retake our society? How do we retake Constantinople? Well, you can't have these, you know, vicious, you know, sending people to attack the capital. You're going to lose. It's never going to happen. John even tried it. No, the only way to do it is to slowly but surely build up, consolidate our forces, to create these, you know, just relationships. You know, John III created a tremendously just, more or less centralized and very law-bound society that was the envy of the region. This is the only reason that Constantinople was ever retaken. It was a purification of the Byzantine idea. This is why John is a saint in the church. He gave everything he had to the cause. The poor were never neglected. The trade surplus always gave the state money necessary, the merchant fleet, as well as military victories. The poor were never neglected. And the Mezuzon always made certain that the connection between the monarch and the population was always very clear. But autarky, nationalism, the slow consolidation of forces versus the short-term running to powerful people for protection. This is the Latins connected to Venice. On the one hand, you see it in the polls later on, and the Byzantine idea found in Nicaea on the other. Again, that's a choice I've been talking about between oligarchy and monarchy for a long time. John III is one of the greatest monarchs in the Middle Ages, one of the greatest Orthodox monarchs of all time, and he did it because he, as I said, carved out this prosperous, very just empire out of nothing, out of a rock. And Theodore is, you know, should be commended too, but John's commitment to justice shows just exactly what monarchy is, and that the struggles of exile and warfare, this is exactly what purified the Byzantine idea. We need to learn from this man. Thank you for listening, everyone, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalists. to Raphael Joseph at RadioArian.com.